Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage's completely online process lets you get a custom mortgage solution wherever and whenever you want. Check out Rocket Mortgage at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Elena Ferrante writes behind a pen name, but has had a lot of success in the real world. Her quartet of novels set in Naples, Italy, has devoted readers across 38 countries and counting. The saga of two Italian women and their friendship from poverty-stricken childhood to old age. It certainly isn't sweetness and light. She writes fiercely with brutal honesty about women and men, motherhood, class, and the complexity of friendship. The real person behind the pen name Elena Ferrante was outed on Sunday, and readers are outraged. This hour On Point, the real world, the fictional world, and the amazing books of Elena Ferrante. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Are you a fan, a fanatic for Ferrante's books? Why? And what did you think when the writer behind Ferrante was outed by an Italian journalist? Who deserves anonymity these days? Does Elena Ferrante? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. We will talk in a few minutes with the woman who has translated Elena Ferrante's books into English, Anne Goldstein. But first, joining me from New York is Alyssa Chappell. She has reviewed Ferrante's books for Vanity Fair, where she's a contributing editor. Last spring, Chappell landed the only interview Ferrante gave in the American press after the publication of the final book of the Neapolitan Quartet. Alyssa's also author of Blueprints for Building Better Girls. Alyssa Chappell, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom, for having me.
Can you explain what happened over this weekend when it comes to the apparent real identity of Elena Ferrante?
Well, the a journalist by the name of Claudio Gatti published a piece in the New York Review of Books and in several newspapers around the world outing Elena Ferrante.
He's an investigative Italian journalist. He went into tax records and more public records to triangulate and figure this out. Why did he do it?
You know, that's a really good question. And while you were talking about how he had discovered her identity by pawing through these financial records and property records, I think a lot of people would have felt a lot better, perhaps, about him outing her if this had included some sort of literary sleuthing instead of, you know, going about it the way that he did.
There's been speculation for years. People have looked at the prose and looked at the facts or purported facts or anyway the details of these stories and tried to shape an opinion of who it might be.
They have, absolutely. I'm not completely sure why we are so focused on knowing who the author of a text is. I think what's wonderful about reading these books, or one of the pleasures, is not knowing who the author is, not reading the book through the lens of the author, not knowing their gender, not knowing perhaps their race, not knowing their age. It allows us to experience the work on a much purer level.
We've got a little tape here of Claudio Gatti, who has outed, apparently, and he points to an editor at the very publishing house that has brought her books out, a woman there who's translated books from German for Edizione EO, the publishing house, for many years. He was on the BBC. They said, well, why? He's come under fire from around the world for doing this. There's an exchange on the BBC on Monday with the Italian journalist Claudio Gatti defending himself.
She's done nothing wrong. That's the point, isn't it? And investigative journalism, classically, would be going after people who have done things that are wrong and need to be uncovered.
Why should lying by best-selling authors to readers who love their work and have a legitimate interest in knowing who the authors are, when, you know, you don't allow politicians to lie their voters?
Now, there's an interesting standard. Alyssa Chappell, the Italian journalist, saying we don't allow politicians to lie. Why should we allow writers to lie? But she's a writer of fiction. Where's the lie come in, even allegedly?
Well, that is absolutely ridiculous, and I'm really glad to hear him say that because it just makes me dislike him even more. this idea that the reader has some sort of right to know who the author is, that we are entitled to know who she is because she has been so successful or because she has made money, is absolutely ludicrous to me. The audience has no right to anything except for the author to give them work that transforms them. I find that just appalling, that idea. And of course, there's a huge difference between politicians and artists. The artist, it leaves it all on the page. It's about the work. To compare this to politics is crazy.
Why do people care so much about Elena Ferrante in particular and her work, Elisa?
Well, I think what speaks to readers so much is her unvarnished honesty, particularly in writing about women's experiences. Very rarely do we find the female friendship, for example, reproduced in such a way that it feels true to us. It's complicated at times. Mm-hmm. It can be ugly. It's emotional. It's difficult. She doesn't hide from all the darkness. Instead, she really confronts it, and she has no problem writing about violence, about the violence of emotion that women feel, or physical violence. She doesn't shrink, and I think that's something that we really respond to as readers. We long for honesty. We hunger for honesty. We want to see our relationships on the page. Have her say the things that we cannot say. That's remarkable.
The writing becomes intimate when you've got that anonymity, she told the Paris Review. To relinquish it would be very painful, she told your publication, Vanity Fair. Do you think her anonymity has been related to her remarkable degree of candor, honesty, openness in talking about the good, the bad, and the ugly, the complex, the super nuanced and very difficult of womanhood, friendship, and all the rest?
I don't know that is true. I think that she is such a brave writer. She is such a moral writer. She is such a she is such a perceptive writer. There's no way in the world that she could not write the books that she is writing the way that she is writing them. I think part of the reason that she didn't want to be named was so that she could, as she says, liberate herself from the anxiety of notoriety. She didn't want to be part of that group of successful people who she says who act as though they who they own the world. But of course she has to take on a persona, which is what Elena Ferrante is, a persona, in order to tell the truths that appear in her books. And I think what's funny is once you have read the books and you take into account that she is writing under a persona, that you see exactly why she had to use her persona to write those books.
She has
because of the way that the male critics have treated her and the way that publishing has treated her. And yes, of course, because she is saying things that women are not supposed to say.
We'll look at a lot of that before this hour is over. She's got a new a book of essays. It's been out in Italian and more, but coming out in English next month, Frontumalia, Bits and Pieces of Unknown Origin, the translation I've got here. We'll hear in a minute from her translator, Anne Goldstein. But when that in that book, she has a letter that she sent to her publisher when her first book, Troubling Love, came out. This is all the way back in 1991. And she's explaining in this letter to her publisher, Elena Ferrante, her choice to remain anonymous. Would you be good enough to read from that, Elisa Chappelle?
Of course. Be my privilege. I believe that books, once they are written, have no need of their authors. If they have something to say, they will sooner or later find readers. If not, they won't. I very much love those mysterious volumes, both ancient and modern, that have no definite author, but have had and continue to have an intense life of their own. They seem to me a sort of nighttime miracle, like the gifts of the Befana, which I waited for as a child. True miracles are the ones whose makers will never be known. Besides, isn't it true that promotion is expensive? I will be the least expensive author of the publishing house. I'll spare you even my presence.
Elena Ferrante writing to her publisher there in 1991, and all these years later, she is all but revealed. I mean, it's not a final, firm, and complete and total assertion that this is her, but it's pretty close to that. Lots of records dragged out here. Lisa Chappelle is with us from Vanity Fair, joins us from New York. Also from New York right now is Anne Goldstein. She has translated all of Elena Ferrante's novels into English. Anne Goldstein, it's a privilege to have you. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
What was your response when you saw that Elena Ferrante has been, I guess, effectively outed?
Well, first I would say that she hasn't necessarily been, that neither the person who, Anita Raya, who's been named as Elena Ferrante, nor her publishers, nor I would say that that is Elena Ferrante.
You're not here to confirm or are you
or
here to deny? Okay, okay.
No, but I just want to say that it's wrong to say that she's been outed. I mean, one should just say someone has claimed to have outed her.
I mean, maybe,
yeah,
but it almost sounds as though you're working to get her identity back in the bottle.
No?
No.
I mean, just saying.
Fair enough.
I meant that as a neutral statement.
There's a margin.
Anyway,
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, of course, as Alyssa said, that listening to that little interview on the BBC was really kind of shocking. that he, his comparison of digging into her identity was like, you know, finding what was going on with a politician. She's not a politician. She's a writer. She has said many times over the years, starting with that first letter, that anonymity is important to her, and she's given the reasons, which have been fairly consistent over the years. And I think that it's, I don't know, it's part of who she is.
Did you feel offended when this assertion came out? Here's the identity of Elena Ferrante?
Yes. I mean, I think I was just so surprised that anybody would do that.
There's no reason to do it.
There's no reason to do it, right.
Well, there's a celebrity culture. It's so strong all over the world. It's especially strong in Italy. it's true.
That's a sickness.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's... I don't think there was any reason to do it.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the purported outing of Elena Ferrante, beloved novelist who wanted to be anonymous, author of the Neapolitan Quartet series, highlighting the fierce complexity of women's friendships, womanhood. Now, against her will, it is claimed, revealed. Many readers are up in arms about it. You can join us this hour. What do you think? Should an artist, this artist, Elena Ferrante, this novelist, have a right to anonymity? And could anonymity be important, even essential to her work, that without it, her work would perhaps not be quite the same? Have you read The Neapolitan Quartet? More, what have Elena Ferrante's books meant to you? Anne Goldstein is with us. She has translated all of Elena Ferrante's novels into English, and that is a great body of work at this point. Alyssa Chappelle is with us as well. She reviewed these books, contributing editor at Vanity Fair. Landed the only interview with Ferrante gave in the American press after her final book in the Neapolitan Quartet came out. Lots of response from listeners already. Pat writes to us, Alyssa, Anne, on Facebook, says it matters to those of us who have read her. We want her to keep on writing. Perhaps this twit's invasion of her privacy will interfere with that. If so, he may want to change his name. And then Pat quotes Elena Ferrante, literary truth is not the truth of the biographer or the reporter. It's not a police report or a sentence handed down by a court. She told the Paris Review, and our listener writes, whether or not this revelation is accurate, I have no idea, but he succeeded in writing his own name in lowercase letters. More callers as well. Nina in New York, Hoosick Falls, New York. Nina, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Thanks so much. I am completely despite of defending anonymity of any writer whatsoever. This is absolutely absurd, and it's appalling. This is an act of a paparazzi who wants to get a little attention himself. I want to quote from The Power of Appropriation by Adam Kirsch, New York Times, yesterday, just to point out how far down we have come in the literary debate. He says, there are good reasons to welcome the revelations about Miss Ferrante. In recent weeks, the literary world has been at war over the idea of cultural appropriation, whether a writer has the right to tell stories about people unlike herself. Isn't that what fiction is? And the fact that this is also about a woman is something that I cannot stress strongly enough. I am a tremendous fan of hers, and so deeply appreciative of the power and honesty about her representing women. And I love the Neapolitan Quartets, and I'm deeply grateful to her. And I think this is a real violation of personal privacy.
And do you see it in gender terms, this journalist outing or purportedly outing her, a woman?
Well, can you think of a male example like this? What about, and people who wanted to protect their privacy, although their names were known, like Pynchon or like Salinger? The point that I'm making is that even apart from the gender issue, which I think is all connected to the fact that she writes powerfully about women, and is that this is an invasion of personal privacy, and the question of whether someone can write about something they don't know, that is the heart of what imagination is. That's a spurious argument that's being put forth by Kirsch in this article. And I really am opposed to any invasion of anyone's privacy. Why? What was to be gained? What was to be gained except this paparazzi person getting his name, Gatti, getting his name in the news?
Nina, I appreciate your call very much. Anne, you've translated so much of this. Do you see a violation, in fact or intended, here?
Yes, well, it is a violation of privacy. I think that was well put. I don't think there, I don't think there was any reason for this. I think there was the reader and the writer enter into a relationship, and the reader, the writer is the person who's written the books, whoever that person is. It's the author of those words.
Elissa, our caller Nina suggests maybe even a broader, deeper violation, a kind of gender transgression here, violation here, sort of the material that Elena Ferrante might pick up in her own work. You've spoken with her. Do you see that here?
Oh, absolutely. And I think you make a very good point there that she needed a persona to write her fiction. And once you read her fiction, you understand why she needed to write with a persona. I think there is something to the gender issue here. Before Elena was, outed, people oftentimes, when they were speculating about who Ferrante might be, actually thought that it might be a man. Yeah. Because the writing is so, the prose is so strong and so lean and so muscular that it had to be written by a man, or perhaps someone suggested a committee of men, which Ferrante finds.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. Finds pretty hilarious. Mm. Now, of course, that's possible. Men write very, write beautifully about women sometimes. But if you read this book as a woman, I think you would assume it was written by a woman. It feels in your bones like a woman. And I do think that there is something there about the gender. When you read what Gatti said, it almost has this feeling of he feels like you said, he like this is unfair. It's unfair for her to keep this secret. By keeping this secret from us, we don't know how to treat her. We don't know how to review her books. If we can't read her work through the lens of gender, we don't know when we sit down to read her books that we should be lowering the bar of excellence, which is what a lot of people feel. They feel women don't write as well as men. And it feels to me a little bit like he thought he had to alert readers to that point, that she was, in fact, a woman. And you know what? Maybe she wasn't as good as everyone thinks because, she was writing about her experience. Or it was unfair because by not claiming that she, right from the start that she was a woman, she is in some way cheating her destiny, which is to be taken less seriously than a man.
I mean, among the ironies here, one of those men who had been speculated about for years as potentially being the writer behind the pen name Elena Ferrante was Domenico Starnon, who is the husband, in fact, of the editor who's now been purportedly outed as the actual writer. He's from Naples. They live in Rome. The journalist went back and said, well, look, this book came out, and then they bought this big apartment. That movie or book came out, then they got the place in Tuscany. Put it all together, triangulate, there it is. And not the husband, but shock, shock, the woman, Lee in Nashville, Tennessee. Lee, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just want to say that I think that this is clearly gender-related. I think this is all part of a loose conspiracy, which is to say that the people who are operating in this way are not necessarily talking to each other. But the point is to drive feminist voices underground. And I think the beauty of what's happened here is it's going to have the opposite effect to some extent. A lot of women are going to be hearing all of this for the first time and going out and buying her books and finding that their feelings, their thoughts, their experiences are being represented. And I think it's going to increase her sales, and I'm glad about that. I hope she finds a way to continue writing. But this is, women are persecuted when they come out and speak openly about the experience of being a woman in a man's world.
I appreciate your call very much, Lee. I want to bring one more voice into the conversation, if I may. Anne Goldstein, Alyssa Chappell, please stand by. Roxana Robinson joins us right now, novelist, biographer. A couple of years ago, she reviewed the third book in the Neapolitan Quartet. She called Ferrante a genius and the book a masterpiece. Author herself of Sparta, Cost, Sweetwater, Asking for Love. Roxana Robinson, thank you very much for being with us today.
I'm honored to be on this show. Thank you for having me.
Why do readers care so much about this author, these books, Roxana?
Well, I've been listening to Anne and Alyssa, and I agree with everything they're saying. I mean, what Ferrante has done is put on the page a kind of candor about the life of women, which we haven't really seen before. And what interested me the most is the way she describes the intersection between violence and the family. And she creates a world in which crime and poverty and the family has produced a kind of fatal triangulation. And so to read about what violence does, and this is all violence against women. Well, no, that's not fair. These Camorra men are violent towards each other, too.
Camorra, you're talking about basically the mafia, the mob in Naples, Italy.
Exactly. And her books are called the Camorra, but it's the mafia. And they are brutal to each other, and they are brutal to their children, and they are brutal to their wives. And the brutality towards their wives is an essential part of these books. And The linking of her anonymity and this violence is something that makes immediate sense to anyone. The idea of revealing this kind of deep, intimate violation of the self in the body and in the mind is something that you would not want to be overt about. It's too dangerous. She's writing about real danger. So her anonymity is something that makes perfect sense.
Should an author be expected to just buck up and give all of that literary truth anyway, even when their identity is purportedly exposed? Or when you say real danger, does that suggest a fear that this might shut her down in some way?
I think that everyone recognizes that the creative process is a mysterious one, that no one is certain that they can draw on it forever, that there are things we don't understand that will close it down. Everyone's afraid, every writer is afraid of something closing her down, herself down, men as well. We don't understand the process. We know there are things that can interfere. One of the things that writers need absolutely is a sense of privacy for their work. You must be alone with the work in order to create it. And in her case, she has said from the beginning that she needs an extra layer of privacy. She's been completely candid about that. She hasn't lied. This is not like a politician who's creating fraud or is being hypocritical. She's never been hypocritical. There is no fraud. She's been candid about this from the very, very beginning.
For those of our listeners who haven't read Elena Ferrante, I want to just give an example, a sample of how intimate and nuanced and telling this writing can be. Anne Goldstein, you've translated all this from the Italian. There's a description in My Brilliant Friendship where the protagonist, Lenu, is helping her friend Lila bathe on her wedding day, preparing for her wedding. And she recalls the sound of the dripping water there and the impression that the copper of the tub had a consistency not so different from Lila's flesh, which it was smooth, solid, calm. But then this is Elena Ferrante writing the voice of the character recalling her own conflicted feelings as a friend preparing another friend, bathing her friend, for her wedding day. Could you read for us, Anne?
Yes, I'd be glad to. I had a confusion of feelings and thoughts. Embrace her, weep with her, kiss her, pull her hair, laugh, pretend to sexual experience and instruct her in a learned voice, distancing her with words just at the moment of greatest closeness. But in the end, there was only the hostile thought that I was washing her, from her hair to the soles of her feet, early in the morning, just so that Stefano could sully her in the course of the night. I imagined her naked as she was at that moment, entwined with her husband in the bed in the new house, while the train clattered under their windows, and his violent flesh entered her with a sharp blow, like the cork pushed by the palm into the neck of a wine bottle. And it suddenly seemed to me that the only remedy against the pain I was feeling, that I would feel, was to find a corner secluded enough so that Antonio could do to me at the same time the exact same thing.
Anne Goldstein, translator of this, reading from the work of Ilana Ferrante. And right there you get all the intimacy, the sort of hostile thoughts at the very same time as the deepest kind of affectionate treatment, bathing a friend, preparing her for her wedding. Annie in Concord, Massachusetts. Thank you for calling, Annie. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Well, I can't speak to the outing issue so much, but I can speak to the just wonderful experience I've had. Reading the quartet, I'm just coming to the end of it. I was traveling in Italy reading some of it, and I felt, boy, this is really a literature of place. I could really, it was wonderful to have it evoked while I was traveling. But I want to just comment on, you know, the intimacy word you're using. Yes, the honesty, the candor, the closeness. I felt honored to be allowed into her psyche, especially because the honesty, she was, you know, she made mistakes. She acknowledged her mistakes. She struggled with her mistakes. She was self-revealing in a way that is like real human life. You know, it was an internal kind of journey with her that was as intimate as any book I ever remember reading. And I just want to comment on how often, it was interesting, I'm sure it's not a coincidence, but how often the word but was used, and I think often started as a chapter. And I loved the you know, the polarities and the sometimes ambivalence and all that word but kept bringing in, and it was just so real to me. And I'm very grateful. Thank you for this series of books, and now I want to go back and read her others.
Oh, Annie, thank you for your call. Roxana, what is it in Ilana Ferrante that takes us to that but, that takes us deeper and maybe shows things in much more of their ambiguity than an ordinary writer might present?
What's so wonderful about Ferrante is that she is relentless. She never lets you rest. There is never a pause in her books. So the opening scene, which I'm sure is seared on everyone's memory, is one in which the two girls, as children, as small children, drop their dolls into the cellar. And then Lila decides that the head of the Camorra, the mafia Don, has somehow taken the dolls, and they go to visit him. And so it's... She plays on the idea of fairy tales, these two little children going to the older man, the chief. And so there's an expectation that since we're dealing with dolls and children, that this will be charming.
Yeah.
And what Ferrante does is never let us assume charm. Charm is not the real world. So there is this drive towards the butt, towards the intimacy, the charm of those two women, one bathing the other in preparation for her marriage night, but the feeling of rage and hostility and the disappointment that this beautiful body is going to be used by someone who's a violent brute. This but is never absent from her work, and it makes it absolutely mesmerizing.
Elisa, did you feel her candid presence when you spoke with Ilana Ferrante?
I'd like to just speak for one moment to what Roxana just said about that kind of violence. What we need to remember is that Ilana is telling the story of Lila about their intense friendship, and she believes she is doing this out of a sense of love. But we also know that Lila very much does not want to be written about. So I love you, but I'm also doing something you very much don't want me to do, which is tell your story.
Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage brings home financing into the 21st century with a completely online process that's fast, easy, and convenient. Using a phone or tablet, you can safely share bank statements and pay stubs without having to dig through piles of paperwork. It takes just a few minutes to get a custom mortgage solution on your terms, wherever and whenever you want. Check out Rocket Mortgage at quickenloans.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumeraccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the novelist Elena Ferrante, purportedly over the weekend outed after many years of keeping her actual real-world identity well concealed behind a very famous pen name now, author of the Neapolitan Quartet, four big books about a friendship grown up out of the streets of Naples that has been read and valued all over the world at this point. Lots of pushback from many readers who say, why on earth would this be revealed? But it has been. Alyssa Chappell joins us from Vanity Fair. Roxana Robinson, novelist and biographer, is here. And Goldstein is with us. She is the translator of Elena Ferrante's novels into English, front to back. Her work right there. If you've read them, you've read her interpretation. You can join us this hour. What about it? Has Elena Ferrante taken you into the mean streets of Naples and the struggles and truths there and made them universal for you? What is it that sets her work apart? And do you worry now for this writer that the privacy she wanted, needed, is gone, that some spell could be broken here? Lots of different kinds of response from listeners here. La Bibliotecris writes on Twitter, of course, this is sexist. Many men write under pseudonyms and their privacy is respected, even applauded as humble. Well, okay, but then Thomas Pynchon has had his, investigations as well. On the other hand, JX writes, I don't understand all this fuss about revealing the author's name, and why hate the journalist who's revealed it? I don't remember this level of fuss when Joe Klein was revealed as author of Primary Colors way back in the early 90s, writing about Bill Clinton, thinly veiled. Rather, I recall speculating who the author was. A fun parlor game for journalists. Is this a double standard we're dealing with? Thinkin writes, is there any such thing as privacy in this world today? Maybe that's the question. I want to get a little more Ferrante actually in our ears, if we could. Anna, I wish you could read a little bit more. There's the but or the ambiguity or the ambivalence comes in many shapes here. There's a wonderful passage where she's writing about motherhood. And I'm trying to see, have you got that reading, Anne?
I have it, yeah.
And sort of the very mixed feelings about motherhood and her husband's attitude toward her as he looks at her in her motherhood. This is from a pre-quartet book called Days of Abandonment. It's her most widely read book in English, even now. Olga, the protagonist here, is 38 years old, married to Mario, lives in Turin. And she's describing her motherhood in a lot of its complexity. Could you read that?
I was like a lump of food that my children chewed without stopping, a cud made of a living material that continually amalgamated and softened its living substance to allow two greedy bloodsuckers to nourish themselves, leaving on me the odor and taste of their gastric juices. Nursing, how repulsive, an animal function. Sometimes Mario pasted himself against me, took me, holding me as I nearly slept, tired himself after work, without emotions. He did it, persisting on my almost absent flesh that tasted of milk, cookies, cereal, with a desperation of his own that overlapped mine without his realizing it. I was the body of incest. I was the mother to be violated, not a lover. Already he was searching for figures more suitable for love.
Translator Anne Goldstein reading there from Elena Ferrante. Alyssa, when you hear that kind of description of the subtleties of motherhood and ambivalence, even about motherhood, I mean, I shouldn't say even, it's just straight up ambivalence in these books. She hits a pretty, pretty nuanced bar of communication there.
She does, and I think that is something that we really, really respond to. Because she's saying the thing that we're not supposed to say, but which we all feel, which is that we do feel ambivalence about being a mother. We do have these dark moments, and the culture tells us we're not allowed to talk about those. We're supposed to hide those. And we simply can't. And I think maybe part of the reason that we don't want to know who Ferrante is because we feel like she's all of us, that she knows our secrets. And so who she actually is of no interest to us. But we also, of course, don't want to have a face put to that experience. I think she's enormously brave. I think that she's remarkably generous. And I'm so grateful for her books. I am so, so grateful. And I know many other women feel exactly the same way.
You had the interview with her, Alyssa. What was that like?
Well, I did, and I need to say that I did not speak to her. Mm-hmm. I mean, that would have been hilarious with my Italian, which is, you know, basically, where's the bathroom, and thank you for that delightful lasagna.
Interview over.
Exactly. So I wrote my questions mm-hmm. to her, and they were given to her. And for all I know, Anne may have translated them. I was so nervous about writing these questions because I didn't know. I had read other interviews with Ferrante. And she is ferocious, and she is quite an intelligence to be reckoned with. So I was rather anxious, and I sent off my questions, expecting that maybe she would answer half of them, and that those answers would be very curt, and they would be hard for me to decipher. And in fact, the opposite was true. She gives beautiful answers. She was generous. She was inspiring. She was darkly funny. She was everything that I could have hoped for. And I felt I'm reading her on the computer screen, mm-hmm. but I literally felt electrified by her words. I just thought, oh my God, here's her voice in my head. I can't believe this is happening. I felt like it was such a privilege and such a gift to be able to have that kind of connection with her. And actually, it's a very good thing I didn't actually speak to her, because I'm sure I would have been in a puddle.
And Goldstein, you're yes. her translator. Were you in the middle of that?
That particular interview, I think, was translated by Michael Reynolds. Mm-hmm. But I have translated a lot of her other interviews. And I think what Alyssa's saying is really true, that she's incredibly generous as a responder to interviewers' questions. And very intelligent, and she takes the questions so seriously. She never puts them off. I mean,
have you spoken
really,
with her, Anne? You've translated
no.
thousands and thousands, I guess, of pages at this point. No, you don't call her up and say, "Hey, Elena, what about this or what about that, or let's have tea, or I'm coming over."
No, I mean, in the beginning, she was much more, I would say, recessive than she mm-hmm. became later. I mean, she gave almost no interviews. I mean, I guess people weren't that interested. But when I had questions in the translations, I went through the editors. I would ask the editors the questions. The editors of Edizione AO are the only people, as far as I know, who know who she is. So I would ask them questions, and they would ask her. Later, she became more open in the sense that she gave more interviews. Mm-hmm. She gave an interview for every country in which the Neapolitan Quartet was published.
I mean, Roxana, you reviewed her back in 2014. You talked about her as one of the great novelists of our time. You weren't all wild praise. You said her writing style is simple, straightforward, headlong, almost to the point of clumsiness. And yet, in your review, great, Roxana.
She is a great writer, and I wanted to make that very clear. I wanted to use those words, masterwork and mm-hmm. genius, because I wanted to put the word out that this is a woman who is doing something no one else has done. I also just wanted to say one more thing about the interviews. And one thing that anonymity has done is to hold the discourse to a level of great intelligence and literary interest. Nobody asks an anonymous person what her favorite color is, what her summer house plans are, where her kids go to school. It's all because of this anonymity. The dialogue and conversation exists in a very, very pure intellectual form, which is wonderful. And there's no other way to do that. Looking somebody in the face, you are reminded that this is a person and that you have a life on the ground. But if you are only doing it through the use of words, you are maintaining something, an intellectual level that just isn't available in other forms.
If Mr. Gotti's right, the editor he points to is the daughter of an Italian father and a Polish-Jewish mother who fled Nazi Germany for Italy and was married there. Do any of the details of the life that is being presented as the real-world life being presented as hers seem to matter in terms of what you've read? Does the biography attached to the named person illuminate what you have read in her books, Roxana?
Well, what happens is, I mean, we all do this whether we want to or not. As soon as you find out facts about the author's life, you sort of put them down like a transparent layer on top of the text and see if they fit. Was that his first wife that he's writing about? Was that really, did he really do that? And it changes your interaction with the text. You just can't help it. So, As I think Alyssa said earlier, reading the text of someone who's anonymous allows us to read it in its purest form. So, I assume that the real writer of these texts, who is Elena Ferrante, does have some deep knowledge of Naples. She must. I don't care what it is. I don't have to track her childhood. She has created a world that is absolutely real and authentic, and that's the world that is the most important one. Her childhood isn't important to me.
We are talking about the purported outing of the novelist Elena Ferrante, pen name, author of the Neapolitan Quartet. Let's get a call from New York. Lily is calling. Hi, Lily. You're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. I think I'm afraid I'm going to be the naysayer. I don't agree with this love fest for Elena Ferrante. I think her books read like soap operas. Number one, I think sentence for sentence, her sentences are not very good. It's, of course, hard to tell because they're translated, but I don't think there's anything extraordinary about her sentences. Number two, I don't identify with the Neapolitan women. My life is very, very different. And three, I think it's human for people to try and find out who she is. In fact, I don't think that's a problem. I think that's very, very natural for people to want to know who the author is.
Lily, I see a note here saying that you are Lily Tuck, author of The News from Paraguay, won the 2004 National Book Award for Fiction. No small figure yourself in literary terms. Do you have any sympathy for Elena Ferrante not wanting to be a publicly known person?
Not really, no. And, you know, my first reaction when I read her was that I thought that she was a man, in fact, because I thought the way she wrote about the female experience was extremely harsh, like when you like the passage, for instance, that Anne Goldstein read mm-hmm. about motherhood. Mm-hmm. I mean, yes, everybody has dark thoughts, but basically I'm extremely happy that I'm a mother and that I have three children. But also, there's one passage that struck me in particular when Lena describes when she first menstruates, and there's this rush of blood, and I don't think that occurs usually. So again, I thought it was a man's take on the whole experience, and I still think that maybe her husband had a part in writing those books.
Lily Tuck, I very much appreciate your call. Alyssa, what do you make of this dissent from a rather well-known author right there and still raising the question even about the gender of the full author of the Elena Ferrante books?
Well, I respectfully disagree with her. I I have to get back to this idea that I don't believe that just because people are curious about something, they deserve to get an answer to it. I think that shows a, you know, impoverished imagination. I disagree with her. And I do think that the writing is glorious. I think it is sharp. I think it is on point. I think it is the kind of writing that makes room for the reader in the work. It allows the reader to collaborate more. You know, the last summer, everyone was talking about Carl Nalsgaard and Nalsgaard mm-hmm. and Ferrante mm-hmm. as being, you know, head-to-head. Were you either team Carl or team Ferrante? And it sounds a little bit like what Lily is talking about is that more expansive rush of language is, which Nalsgaard is known for, is much more pleasing to her, perhaps, or much more deserving of praise. And I disagree. I mean, to me, you know, if we're talking about female text and male text, that kind of text, that more meandering language and more expansive writing feels to me very masculine, because it's that's a voice that never imagines that they will be cut off or interrupted. I think Ferrante's style very much suggests that she needs to say what she says quickly and cleanly, so she's, you know, in order to be heard.
Anne Goldstein, you've been as deep into this writing as anyone, as the translator of all these books. Have you ever wondered about, questioned the gender of the real author? Lily Tuck says, sounds like a man to her.
No, I've always felt since I started translating these books that they were written by a woman. I mean, of course, it is a woman's voice, but I've always felt that the way she describes emotions, the way she examines emotions, in a single sentence, she will start with one thing and then go deeper and deeper into that emotion until she gets to some sort of what she considers some sort of truth, even if it's an ambiguous truth. And she doesn't stop, and I somehow feel that that's a female. I mean, I don't want to be too gender specific, but I do think it's kind of a woman thing to do.
Roxana, the gender of this author, whoever the true author may be?
I just agree with Alyssa and Anne. It feels to me deeply, deeply obvious or clear that it's a woman.
And a woman writing with the kind of freedom that has been, she says, nurtured by her anonymity, and an anonymity perhaps now lost. We'll see what follows. Anne Goldstein, I hope you keep translating. It's been wonderful translation so far, and we thank you very much for being with us today. Thanks for joining us, Anne.
Thank you.
Anne Goldstein in New York. Alyssa Chappell at Vanity Fair, thank you so much for joining us today, Alyssa.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And Roxana Robinson, author of Sparta, Cost, Sweetwater, Asking for Love. Always wonderful talking with you, Roxana. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.